This is not a Bristol Con Fringe podcast. It's an extract from the launch of the Fight Like a Girl anthology, which is edited by our very own Joanne Hall and Ros Clark.
Big round of applause for Lou, please. Hello, thank you. Right, can you hear me? Because I have terrible, terrible microphone juju and they always break. Is it all working? Good. Thank you all very much for coming, and thank you to all of the amazing ladies that are involved in this. I just think it's the coolest thing I've seen in ages. I'm going to give you a short reading, which is the beginning of my story, which is Archer 57. The title kind of gives away that archery is important. It's a funny story because it started off life as a comic script, and it didn't really work as a comic, so then I turned it into a story. Anyway. Here we go, Archer 57. You can learn a lot crawling through a tunnel. A lot about yourself, a lot about the world you live in, a lot about what collects at the bottom of a tunnel. And I've crawled through a lot of tunnels. You'd think more people would use them. Once you know your way through them, you can get anywhere, and quickly. There are no checkpoints down here, no snipers or mines to dodge, just grenades. It takes a while to learn to navigate them, true, especially if you're used to the grid system above ground. There are no maps for the underworld. Orpheus could have told you that, stumbling along in the Evernight. The tunnels work in circles. They're a coil of snakes swallowing their own tails, looping round and round under what's left of the city. I know there are others like me, slipping through the shadows and the junk. I hear them sometimes, hear echoes and footsteps and what could be voices in the distance, or could just as easily be the wind over a vent. They call us rat runners up above. I've heard it through gratings, down ventilation shafts and from the other side of grills. They laugh when they say it. Did I, when I was in their place? I don't remember. I don't remember thinking about who might be down here at all. Maybe nobody was back then. Sometimes they'll throw a firecracker. Sometimes they'll throw a bomb. They don't really care if we're on their side or the enemy's, loyal or adverse. We remind them of what they could become. They don't care what we are now, but they can't look past what we were, where we came from, and how we got here. Maybe that's why they enjoy killing us. I don't remember what the city looked like before the war. I'm not sure I ever really knew what it looked like at all. We seem to have been at war forever. It's always been said that the Steel Wars would end all wars. They've ended a lot of things, I suppose, but not war. And in those early days, as the fight raged on and the bombs fell, and one by one the men either volunteered or were conscripted or were, finally, rounded up in cattle trucks and shipped to the front, the world before crumbled. This is all that's left. War and ruins and bones. Perhaps this will be the last war, because it will only end once we're all dead. Once the men were gone, they came for the boys. Teenagers at first, then down to 10, 7, 6, 5. They took my son on his 4th birthday, throwing open the door to our home and dragging him away. I could hear him screaming in my head for days. I still can if I listen hard enough to the silence. For a while, I couldn't tell whether the screams I heard were his or mine as I walked the street in the dark, stepping between rubble mounds and screaming. And were my screams any different from the screams of every other mother, every other woman who had lost someone, had someone ripped away from her? When the screaming stopped, his, mine, ours, and my head cleared, I knew what I wanted. And within a month, I was being walked to my new bunk in the barracks. With every war, a new weapon, a new way of fighting emerges, and this one is no different. Except this time, we've not looked to the future. We look to the past. Not to the drones or the rockets or the death from afar dealt by our forefathers, no. In this war, archers are the new old weapons of mass destruction, and I was one of the best. I was one of the best because I had nothing to lose. Or at least I thought I didn't. There is always something more to lose. To an archer, a fight is personal. We stand, we pick our target, and we keep them. If we miss once, we aim again. We pick out a man, a woman we've never met, and we make them carry the burden of the whole war. We promise them, promise ourselves, that we will not stop until they are dead. And when they fall, we look for the soldier beside them. I ran sorties. I ambushed whole companies of adverse. I ambushed them and I did not stop killing them until my hands and my face were red and I could barely remember my name. I lost myself in death because I had already lost so much else. My arrows found their mark and I showed no mercy, seeing in each and every face, not adverse, but the loyals who had taken my son, my husband, my life, my world. I killed without thought and without hesitation because I was killing my own. I was expecting them to kill me when they captured me. They slaughtered the rest of my squad where they stood, kicking what was left of them one by one into a pit. Why they didn't do the same to me, I don't know. I was ready for it. Instead, they took the first two fingers of my right hand, and then they threw me to the wolves, the ones who'd been handing me medals 2 days before. An archer who can't shoot is no use to anyone, and a useless soldier is just another mouth to feed. The fall from archer to rat is a short one. It's no greater than the width of two fingers under a blade.
Thank you very much.
Our next reader is Sophie Tallis, and when Sophie's done her reading, I will then immediately be handing over to Cheryl Morgan, who is moderating our panel discussion today. So if you can all stay sat after Sophie's finished, obviously give her a hearty round of applause, and then we'll be moving on to the panel. Thank you very much.
Thank you, guys. Okay, this is an extract from my story, Silent Running. It started off actually as the first book I ever wrote when I was 18, a science fiction saga. And this was the hardy story of where you should always back your work up, because I lost the entire book when my computer went kaput. Anyway, when I heard about this, I still had those characters knocking around in my head, so I created a whole new short story. And this is an extract from that, so Silent Running. The Dekeel transport groaned and lurched once more. Then all the screaming engines fell silent and Adi was plunged in darkness. She waited for the emergency lighting to come online, but nothing. All systems were down. She sensed the air vents closing. Life support was offline. In a ship this size and with a skeleton crew, they probably had a day of breathable air before the atmosphere turned toxic. This was a coordinated attack. She quietened her breathing. A 20-year military career had taught her battle techniques, but the Thrall War had taught her guerrilla tactics and turned her into a killing machine, driven by grief and rage. Despite her enforced convalescence and the healing programs she'd been made to attend after the war, she had never lost her edge or her age. She put the pulsar gun away and took out her killing blade. It was time to hunt. Removing her shoes and any articles of clothing that could make a noise, she waited for her eyes to adjust to the dark. She had trained herself in this too, and her night vision was excellent. Allowing her body to find its equilibrium, she used what had been the ceiling to swim along the corridor. She sensed no movement, no sign of life. She moved swiftly, following the only muffled sounds to be heard, the faintest echoes from deep in the belly of the ship. Her eyes found the shapes of dead crewmen floating lifelessly in the gloom. Blood drifted in the darkness, globules bouncing against her skin, bursting open in her hair. Her senses alerted to a slow-moving shadow moving down the corridor. Three shadows. They were walking, not floating. Magnetic boots. Adi floated above their heads. They hadn't seen her. They were headed for the astronauts' quarters. She felt a twinge of regret. This would be over too soon, and she wanted it to last. She pushed off from the ceiling and headed for the last of the figures. The continued sounds of fighting from deep below told her these weren't the only traitors on board. She glided down, blade twitching in her hand, wanting its target. It found it. In one deft movement, she landed on the shoulders of the last man like a black spider and grabbed the back of his head. She pulled it back before he could react and plunged the knife through his eyeball and into his brain. She felt the hilt scrape against the bone of his eye socket. Sure it had gone in far enough, she slid it out, wiping the jelly on his cheek as she let his limp body drift to the floor, his boots anchoring him like a piece of waving sea kelp. On to the second. She saw the next man freeze and turned. Had he heard anything? Too late. Before he had a chance to call his accomplice, her blade drove deep into his skull. This time, and to Adi's surprise, a gargled sound escaped his lips. The first figure turned. Quiet! He hissed. Then cursed as he saw the glint of steel in the dark. Adi had to move quickly. She saw the gun being raised. She threw the killing blade with deadly accuracy and saw the hand go limp and the gun float away. It was almost comical, even in this gloom, seeing these slumped, swaying figures. Adi drifted over to the last attacker and pressed her foot down on his head, pulling the knife from his skull with an awful sucking sound. Three down, but how many more were there? She checked them all and stripped them of their weapons. No tags, pilot cards, nothing to identify them other than the universal translator units hidden under their clothes and fixed to each one's voice box. She checked the corridor again. Silence. Placing one of the units against her ear, she fiddled with a reverse button. "Who are they?" she whispered, and heard the unit repeat the words in a distinctive Oskillian accent. Adi smiled. "Got you." Oskillus was one of Kalan's outer colonies and a sector that many Thrall ships had been seen travelling through. Adi had long suspected it of colluding with the enemy. Here was the proof. And breathe.
Okay, welcome back again, everybody. I'd like to introduce now our last reader of the day, who is our instigator, the amazing Danny Ware.
Thank you. Before I get started on the reading, there's been a lot of talk, or some talk, about this being a book about women proving themselves, about... It's almost been a sense of exclusivity and standing up and shouting. But I'd like to think that this is also a book about celebration and about the fact that we don't need to prove ourselves, because we are. You know, this isn't a book about proving a point. This is a book about everybody standing up together. And with that in mind, there have been a lot of men who have also supported this book, who have got behind it, who have involved their female friends, who have been really, really supportive of it. And the thanks goes to them too, because this isn't a book about separation. This is a book about celebration. So I'm going to read the beginning to my story, Unnatural History. And if anybody recognises the location, they can tell me afterwards. The thing was huge. It filled the pale stone of the old hall from floor to broken roof. It was a monstrous ripple of texture and colour, glinting and seething, pulsing with hunger. It had consumed everything, accepted the building's long history as fuel for its size and might, and now it rose before us, looking down at our foolishness with a wide and mineral grin. "There you are," it seemed to say. "Come to me at last." Huddled behind me, the group from the old train weren't fighters. They'd heard the bike engine and spilled out from the abandoned station at South Ken. They'd greeted me like some street hero of old, patting my arm and babbling horrors. They'd pointed at the rifle over my back and then vaguely, helplessly northwards. They'd known it was there, known it would come for them, known it would roll forward over the overgrown ground and leave that wide swath of desolation behind it. They'd known they could do nothing to stop it. Now they cowered in front of it like acolytes. I was their priestess, their scarred goddess of dirt and boots. The doorway and the long steps down to the derelict street were behind us, but nothing lay that way, only the endless creeper and the corpses of the long-forgotten cars. In front of us, by the rotting gods, this monster wasn't the first of these things I'd seen, but it was easily the biggest. It blocked the mighty hall like a lump in its throat. It bulged across the floor and obscured the stairways. Ash-grey light fell from the ruined roof and glinted upon its shoulders. Katja! Katja! Kate! The train group's leader was calling me. He was an older man, savvy enough to survive, to watch. I could feel he was gesturing, but didn't dare to turn and look. My eyes were on the monster, on the history of the world held within its body. You, I told it silently, are as dead as this bastard city. I cocked my father's old bolt action, that satisfying ka-chank, ka-chank that I'd learned as a teenager. The thing rippled again, stretched as high as the roof, the light dancing, the movement smooth and fluid. There was bone in there, sucked in and held in suspension. It was dark with age, huge pieces of it now broken into filthy shards. Some of it was still pierced through with twisted, rusted steel. There were bits of animal and crystal, stone from the walls and floor, metals from the banisters, old wood from the last of the furniture. The broken glass of the shattered windows made its eyes, and they glittered with the remnants of the patterns within. When it moved, it rumbled like a building coming down. But I didn't care, rotting thing. With a tight focus, I put the old rifle's butt against my shoulder, sighted, took one glass eye clean out of its head. It rocked back, keening, then its face inverted and opened again like some blossoming of urban debris, and the light was replaced, eye was replaced, winking at me. Shit. Somewhere behind it, the weed-grown staircases joined at a single white statue, the head of an old man who watched the scene in silence, his judgment withheld. Whoever he was unimpressed by my shooting. The train people were crying out now, instructions and fear. Their leader shouted at them to stay quiet, his voice firm. I cocked the rifle again and took a second shot, this time at the monster's grinning mouth. It swallowed the round hole, spitting tiny fragments as if it would belch in satisfaction. Shit, shit, shit. Not wasting more ammo, I slung the rifle and ducked to pick up my old shield. I'd made this when my father died from a dustbin lid and an old road sign, made it the day I'd held to my promise and gone to find other survivors. I'd been 19 and my father had been everything, parent, trainer, insight, courage. Gods and rot, he would have known how to deal with this bastard thing. But he'd been dead 20 years, more. This was my world now, the world I'd made my own. The beast shuddered with textures. They ran over its surface like water. It lowered itself to a bulbous fatness and eyed me with its fat head cocked to one side. Cold grey light flashed from its movements, made me blink so I almost missed it, the bulge that was one flank exploding into a huge uncurling tentacle. It threw it out at me, scattering pieces, hard edges of bone, fragments of the little stone creatures that had once clung to the walls. I blocked it with a crack that skidded me backwards, slashed down at it with my heavy old Bowie knife, the blow brutal. Crippled, the tentacle crashed to the stone floor, twitching, but a slurp of the beast's underside simply sucked it back up again. Rotting hell. I'd no idea how long this thing had been in here, seeping through doors and levels, swelling as it absorbed every artifact and memory. It shuddered, making the old walls shake. Pieces of the roof fell to shatter before it, and it rolled forwards, picking up the bits as it came. A second tentacle, this one with a claw tip like some huge and scrabbling insect, clacked shut just short of my blade hand, withdrew, but not fast enough. A flashing over and backhand with the knife and the end clattered, severed to the floor. I kicked it away before the beast could roll forwards again, but this wasn't good enough, just wasn't taking enough of its body mass. The little ones exploded from a well-aimed round of 303, or they fell to pieces if you hacked hard enough. But not this thing. It had to be 10 times the size of anything else I'd seen. I felt a tremor that might have been panic, dismissed it. As it rippled again, I could see now there were bodies in there too, pieces of human life that may once have lived or visited here, or taken refuge in this great hall when the end of the world had come.
Fight Like a Girl is published by Grumbold Books, an imprint of Crystal Ink, and is available from good bookstores everywhere. Our thanks to the Hatchet Inn in Bristol for providing us with a venue.